Okay.
Just have 1 second. Okay. Thank you.
Morning, Kenneth.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Andrew Ittleman. I'm here on behalf of Cytori Therapeutics. Together with me today is Mitchell First, also of my law firm, and Mr. Ken Kleinhans and Chris Calhoun of Cytori. They've traveled in from San Diego to be here. Your Honors, in 1976, Congress had a decision to make. Medical devices were proliferating the market. Many of them were brilliant, but Congress had not yet drafted any laws that were specifically designed to regulate them. And Congress knew that it needed to protect the market from potentially dangerous devices, but did not want to do so in such a way as to inhibit innovation. So Congress got together and held hearings. And after lengthy hearings and careful consideration, Congress wrote, Congress developed a balanced regulatory proposal intended to assure that the public was protected from unsafe and ineffective medical devices, that health professionals have more confidence in the devices they use and prescribe, and that innovations in medical device technology are not stifled by unnecessary restrictions. And Congress further found that the new authority it was creating must not unnecessarily burden the small manufacturers of medical devices who have been responsible for the development of a host of important and innovative devices. And the medical device laws were thus born. And the cornerstone of the medical device statutes is the 510K provision. And in the 510K provision, unlike drugs, new devices must be substantially equivalent to a predicate or predicates, and they need not prove to the FDA that they are safe and effective in an absolute sense. And today, roughly 99% of all medical devices which are reviewed by the FDA and which are made available on the market come onto the market through the 510K procedure.
But substantial equivalence is obviously a term that connotes a significant amount of discretion to FDA to determine what is substantially equivalent. They're experts in that. We're certainly not. And how can we second guess their determination in a case like this where they look at the products on the market and determine this is not substantially equivalent and thus has to go through the more stringent pre-market approval process? And they explain in some depth the reasons. Fat is not blood, to get to the core of the issue. How can we second guess that?
Well, Your Honor, the question that's asked assumes that that went into the procedure, that went into the review process of the FDA. Mm-hmm. And here we're not, The review that Congress created for this process is not one of substantial evidence. We're not here to look at the evidence that the FDA looked at and say...
What is the standard, Dan?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What is the standard?
Well, it's an APA standard of review.
Arbitrary and capricious.
Correct.
Right.
So the point...
Arbitrary and capricious.
Right.
Many times and gives agencies a lot of discretion. Obviously, if there's a specific statutory term, we enforce that. But when it's just, did the agency reasonably analyze the evidence to determine whether something's substantially equivalent, that's a high bar to clear.
Judge, I'm not disputing any of that.
Right.
None of it. I mean, that's all very clear. The case law on that issue goes back for decades. Mm-hmm. But the case law of this circuit says that deference does not mean abdication. And the case law of this circuit also says that no matter what the discretion is or the deference is that we give to the agency, we need to conduct a searching review of what the FDA did. And here, what the FDA did was virtually nothing. They received the 510K notifications, and they rejected them, period. And not only did they just reject them, but they rejected them based upon looking at evidence and looking at issues which Congress specifically told it not to look at. And then the other issues that Congress
What was that?
Yeah. Go ahead with it. Expound on what that is, Congress, that they did that Congress told them not to.
Okay. Congress told the FDA what to consider and what not to consider when reviewing a 510K notification. And what Congress clearly came out and did in the FDAMA amendments to the FDCA in 1997 was tell the FDA that when reviewing a 510K notification, you are only to look at the statement of intended use.
Can you read the language of Congress you're referring to?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Can you read the language of Congress that you're referring to?
Yes, Your Honor. And this is at 21 U.S.C. 360C. The C is not in parentheses. And then E, Romanet 1, capital E. Any determination by the Secretary of the intended use of a device shall be based upon the proposed labeling submitted in the 510K notification. And what we see when we look at the...
There's not language that explicitly says negatives of what not to look at.
Well, yeah.
You seem to be arguing there was an explicit command not to look at something, and you just told me about a specific command is what you would look at. Now, they're not inconsistent, but they're not the same thing, are they, Counsel?
Well, in a sense, they are, Judge. When we look at the legislative history of what that statute meant, and that part of the statute came in 1997 as part of FDAMA.
Do you seriously expect me to look at legislative history?
Well, I'm going to read it to you if that's okay, Your Honor.
Do you seriously expect me to pay much attention to legislative history?
I do.
Have you been in this court before?
I have, Your Honor.
Okay.
And what the legislative history provides is very clear. The committee does not want FDA to exceed its jurisdictional responsibilities by incorporating into the review process claims not before the agency for review consideration. That's what Congress meant when it wrote that statute in the way that it did. So here we have the FDA looking at issues in such a... We have FDA looking at issues in such a way that Congress specifically told it not to. And then when those other issues...
There again, counsel, you're expanding what Congress did. Congress didn't specifically tell it not to.
Your Honor, that would be the second point.
I assume what you told me out of the statute was the best language you had about what Congress specifically told
us. Well, the statute also says that if the FDA does look at those issues, it needs to consider mechanisms of regulating the device that are less drastic than simply rejecting the 510K notification. And when we go down a little bit
further... Give me that language.
Okay. When determining that a device can be found substantially equivalent to a legally marketed device...
Can be found.
Correct.
Go ahead.
The director of the organizational unit responsible for regulating devices, in this case the director, may require a statement in labeling that provides appropriate information regarding a use of the device not identified in the proposed labeling if, after providing an opportunity for consultation with the manufacturer and on and on and on. So, yeah. Again, you're
on. Yeah, and the Congress provided lesser remedies, but that's a long way from saying Congress said you have to go to the lesser remedies.
Well, what Congress may not necessarily have said you have to go to the lesser remedies.
Right.
But what the case law of the Supreme Court and this circuit provides for is that if the FDA is going to use the most drastic mechanism available, it needs to explain why less drastic remedies were not available to Sitori. And this it didn't do. It got the 510K notifications, it looked at them, it didn't like them, and it shut them down, period.
Well, you say didn't like them, and you said before they didn't explain. They say we're not aware of a legally marketed device labeled or promoted for the intended use in the clinical laboratory, et cetera, from adipose tissue for further clinical testing. In addition, the intended use of this device differs from the intended use of the predicate devices. So they both say they're not aware of a product now that is like this one, and the intended use is different. And
right, I understand the question that you're asking, Judge. And the point that you're getting at is the definition of substantial equivalence
exactly.
And same intended use. Mm-hmm. And the question that arises is whether my device that accesses cells or a cell concentrate through adipose tissue can have the same intended use or can be substantially equivalent to a device that accesses that cell concentrate through blood or through cord
blood. Exactly. So the blood and the adipose tissue, if they had concluded it was substantially equivalent, I doubt we'd be in a position to...
Well, we wouldn't be here today.
Right, now I understand that.
Somebody else might have brought it
yeah,
here
right.
Today.
I don't know that a court would
they
be
would have.
Position to second-guess that. I'm just saying either way FDA went on a question like that with a distinction that seems to make some sense.
Well, theoretically, and I guess in a vacuum it might, because, yes, the one is not the same thing as the other. But first of all, we're talking about substantial equivalence. We're not talking about identical.
Right, and that's the kind of word that normally we expect agencies to have discretion to.
And I would agree with that, Your Honor, if the FDA's own guidance document governing the issue didn't fly in the face of the decision that the FDA made in this case. Its guidance documents provide examples of devices where that access the body in two different ways, but at the end of the day have the same intended use. They talk about non-implanted blood access device, and this is from the 1986 guidance document that we included as an attachment to our reply brief. They discuss non-implanted blood access devices, conventional dialyzers, blood tubing sets, and they don't do things, the new device and the predicate device don't do things the same exact way. But that's not the point, because the point of all of these statutes in the first place is to encourage innovation and encourage development of new devices.
Well, and safety.
Correct.
You know,
but
that's a balance.
But I'm going to address that point before I move on with anything else.
Yeah.
Because in 1997, when Congress was writing these laws, Congress also changed the mission of the FDA, and that new mission is found at 21 U.S.C. Section 393. And what Congress wrote is that the agency should be guided by the principle that expeditious approval of useful and safe new products enhances the health of the American people. Approving such products can be as important as preventing the marketing of harmful or ineffective products.
Right.
So when we're talking,
wait,
when
so
we're
talking. Let me stop you right there.
Okay.
So that language you just read, which was meant to be a refutation, actually confirms that there's a balance.
Correct.
Between getting things onto the market and making sure that the things that get onto the market are safe.
Correct.
And FDA's got to strike that balance. It's not easy, but in this case, they have a lot of room.
But they do have room, and they do have a certain amount of discretion, but they need to go through the process, and that process is set forth by Congress. And they didn't do it. If FDA had legitimate concerns regarding the safety and effectiveness of this device, they had an obligation to communicate with Sitori and to ask for additional information. And the statute.
That obligation is from where?
That's statutory, Your Honor.
How stated?
I believe that's in 21 U.S.C. 360C again, Your Honor. And what the point is there is that when the FDA asks for information from the manufacturer, regarding the safety and effectiveness of a new device, it needs to do so in the least burdensome way possible. All of this, from the jurisdiction of this court to the communication that's supposed to take place between the FDA and the medical device manufacturer, all of it is designed to lead to efficiency and innovation. When the FDA sees a device and they have questions, which the government actually raised in their brief, they weren't sure why we said certain things about the device, they have an obligation to do more than just reject it. They have an obligation to explore the gray area that exists between the least and the most draconian methods of regulating the device that are available. They have that obligation under the jurisprudence of this court, and they did not do that in this case. They just shut it down. They aborted their job. And that's what's arbitrary and capricious. We're not here to talk about the science of the devices. We don't raise the issues. Frankly, I don't know if we ever will have the opportunity to do so. What we're talking about here is the review itself, globally, what they did and what they didn't do.
What's the best language you have on that obligation you say they did not fulfill?
That would be from the motor vehicles case, Your Honor.
All right.
And
that language is? I mean, when you're flatly relying on the statement that an agency has an obligation and hadn't fulfilled it, it's not unfair to ask you to give us the obligation.
It's certainly not unfair, Your Honor, and I don't want to mince the words of the Supreme Court, so I'm going to pull out the language. I can describe what it means to you, but I don't think that's what you're looking for.
Quoting from State Farm?
Yes.
I think so.
That reaffirms a lot of discretion. Mm-hmm.
It certainly does. But it also affirms the position that we're taking here, that at a minimum, and this is at page 35 of our initial brief, the agency must have considered relevant data and articulated a satisfactory explanation establishing a rational connection between the facts found and the choice made. Additionally, agency action will be found to be arbitrary and capricious if the agency has relied on factors which Congress has not intended to consider, entirely failed to consider an important aspect of the problem, offered an explanation for its decision that runs counter to the evidence before the agency, or is so implausible that could not be ascribed to a difference in view or
the
product.
Where are you quoting from?
That's the motor vehicle case again, Your Honor.
Right before that, the part you quoted, it says the scope of review under the standard is narrow and a court is not to substitute its judgment for that of the agency.
Correct. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. And we're not asking the court to do that. Mm-hmm. But this the statute that gives the court jurisdiction in this case has meaning. And the court is, when receiving that subject matter jurisdiction, is not simply to abdicate it to the FDA, and because the FDA said so, then we have to agree with it automatically. We need to conduct a searching and thorough inquiry.
We have now gone beyond your allotted time. We'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Hear from the respondent.
Adam Jed for the government, Your Honors. May it please the court, the devices at issue here operate on a different substance using a different mechanism, a proprietary enzyme, and the limited data which exists shows that it actually has a detrimental effect on the cells at issue. Now, before I jump into addressing the exchange between my friend and Judge Sintel, I just wanted to point out one thing, just jumping ahead briefly, is that the second statutory requirement that when there are different technological characteristics, it can't raise new questions of safety and efficacy, we address at some length in our brief, and I don't believe that petitioner's reply brief actually disputes that any of what we say is correct, and I don't believe that petitioner's reply brief suggests that any of the process concerns he has, I'll talk about those process concerns in a moment, but I don't think he suggested that any of those process concerns even could have possibly infected that second prong of FDA's determination. So I'm happy to discuss all of the process concerns, but as I understand it, this is an independent ground and one that would actually, by statute, require that FDA find both devices are not substantially equivalent, and it's one that petitioner really has not disputed. Now, if I could just jump into the colloquy between Chief Judge Sintel and my friend, The premise of my friend's argument is this assertion that FDA inserted into the process some sort of irrelevant or improper consideration. And Judge Kavanaugh, I agree with you, of course, that FDA has a lot of discretion in the sorts of things it considers and how it evaluates them. But I actually just want to challenge my friend's premise, because I think his brief is fairly light on details there, and it's something that we tried to address in ours. For the most part, the comments that he points to that he infers mean that FDA had considered irrelevant off-label considerations just don't support that premise at all. So, for example, if I could point your honors to page 45 of the opening brief, my friend argues that because the summary review memorandum discussed the possible effects of returning the reagent to a patient, that therefore FDA must have been considering some sort of improper off-label use. Now, there are a couple of things to say in response to that, Your Honor. First of all, this was the device that was sent to CBER, the office that, by definition, only considers devices that will be producing biological products. If you look at page 21 of my friend's brief, he actually concedes that the definition of what that device does, I'm now quoting, assumes that cells are, quote, returned to the patient. And since his main concern seems to be exactly what was part of the labeling, if I could point your honors to in the joint appendix, page 312, that is a manual that was submitted along with the draft product labeling. Joint appendix page 310 labels that section draft product labeling. And then if you look at joint appendix page 312, it actually shows that manual. And that manual says that the cellular product produced is, quote, ready for preservation, which on page 21 of my friend's opening brief, he points out that the idea of cryobanking or preservation assumes that the product might be returned to the patient. And throughout our brief, we cite other portions of the joint appendix where my friends or Cytori's comparison to the predicate devices all include the fact that this is being done for banking or cryopreservation or for returning to the patient. Joint appendix page 298 says, quote, it shares the same intent of delivering minute amounts of residual reagent back to the donor. So when my friend stands up here and says that FDA was using some off-label consideration, FDA was looking at petitioner's own label, petitioner's own manual, and petitioner's own submissions. And the statement in FDA summary review memorandum that my friend is trying to rely on just doesn't show otherwise. There are several other examples of that in which we discuss in our brief, and I'm happy to discuss with your honors. If you're honors have any questions about the jurisdictional argument, we would be happy to discuss that as well.
It's not the strongest.
Yeah. You may want to move beyond that one.
I understand, Your Honor. I think we've basically covered what we need to cover. I'm happy to discuss any other issues that the panel might be interested in, or if the panel's willing to give me a moment to try to revive the jurisdictional argument, I would be happy to do that as well, but I don't want to waste Your Honor's time.
I'll just elaborate that the text is, in my view, pretty clear. The legislative history has a contrary comment, but even if you believe in the use of legislative history to help interpret ambiguous provisions, you can't use it to alter the text. And here, I thought your position about the relying on the legislative history would alter what the text would say on jurisdiction.
Sure, Your Honor, obviously.
That was my evaluation.
Sure, so I think we disagree with the textual argument. If you look at 360GA8, it authorizes review of an order pursuant to 360CI. And then the only order which appears there is where the secretary, by order, has found that the device meets the various characteristics that are necessary to find substantial equivalence. So even for those of you who aren't interested in the legislative history, we think that what the legislative history indicates actually aligns exactly with what the text says.
This is an order, you agree?
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Your Honor?
This is an order.
So what happened in this case, of course, colloquially could be referred to as an order.
And not just colloquially, legally.
It's
an order under the APA.
Well, Your Honor, the direct review provision doesn't just say any order. It says an order pursuant to the section.
You're right. Okay.
And then in that section, it only defines one particular kind of order.
If this is not an order made pursuant to 360C1, what's the statutory authority for it?
Well, Your Honor, remember that the default here by statute, a new device is a Class 3 device. And if you look at 360CF1, within F1 it actually spells out that a new device is automatically a Class 3 device unless it's substantially equivalent. And so essentially, someone who has a new device comes to FDA and they say, here's our new device. We know that it's supposed to be Class 3, but please issue an order taking us out of Class 3 and putting us into Class 1 or Class 2, whatever it would be substantially equivalent
to. There is an order here.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
There is an order here, though, and Judge Brown is asking you, what is this order pursuant to?
Well, I guess what I would say is this is a denial of an order. That Satori came and said—
An order denying.
Yeah. A denial of an order is an order under the—
Yeah, it's an order denying, right.
Sure, and again, I mean, of course—
You may get the idea you're not getting much traction out of this.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Do Your Honors have any other questions on the merits issue? We'd be happy to discuss that.
Okay.
No? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Not going to address the jurisdictional issue. Everything that the government is arguing in this case is about an off-label use, an unintended use of the two devices. That's everything. That's what they rely on. It's what they relied on in the administrative record, and it's what Mr. Jed just relied on up here. What they are talking about, they have no problem with the intended use of the devices as they were submitted by Satori. Instead, upon receiving the 510K notifications, the FDA turned the 510K notifications into straw men, and they evaluated the 510K notifications based on intended uses not contemplated and not submitted by Satori. And then they rejected the 510K notifications based on those new intended uses not contemplated by Satori. And what the statute provides for, again, is that when the FDA is evaluating a 510K notification, they need to evaluate it based on the statement of intended use that's submitted by the manufacturer. And if the FDA has concerns about some sort of an off-label use, then it goes to the second part of 21 U.S.C. 360C-E1E, which is to consider some sort of alternative means of regulating the devices, such as labeling or a black box warning or something along the lines of telling doctors out there, don't use this device for X, Y, and Z, or it hasn't been evaluated for safety and effectiveness of some other type of indication not contemplated by Satori. And again, they didn't explore any of it. It's not in the record. They didn't tell us why not. And so unlike 99.1% of all other devices that are cleared by the FDA were sent into this place where there's no windows and no doors, and we're supposed to—
Your time's up, counsel. Case is submitted.
Your Honors, I appreciate it.
We'll take a brief recess.